course, but it's a relief for the waiters.
The robot is equipped with a trolley and it can easily move around in the restaurant. When it comes to saving time, the high-tech waiters is of great help, especially when the restaurant is packed with customers. The owner says most customers first become surprised when they come across the robot. He says waiters are still present to serve meals and receive orders.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Limelight. 2021 was a tragic year for Yemenis, millions of whom are struggling with poverty, hunger, and severe restrictions on their freedom of movement due to the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led invasion of the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, UN Envoy Warns Threat to Civilian Lives is Increasing in Yemen. Stay tuned for more. A United Nations special envoy raised alarm about the safety of civilians in war-torn Yemen, given escalating violence, including airstrikes by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. The escalation in recent weeks is among the worst we have seen in Yemen for years, and the threat to civilian lives is increasing, said Hans Grudenberg, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' special envoy for Yemen, in a statement. Airstrikes on Sana'a have resulted in loss of civilian lives and damaged civilian infrastructure and residential areas, he added. The continued offensive on the Ma'arib and the continued missile attacks on the governorate are also resulting in civilian casualties, damage to civilian objects, and mass displacement. The UN Development Program projected last month that the death toll for the war in Yemen, including victims of indirect causes such as disease and hunger, will reach 377,000 by the end of this year, and an estimated 70% of those killed would be under the age of five. Grudenberg also expressed concern that any targeting of civilians and civilian objects, as well as indiscriminate attacks by any actor, is a flagrant violation of international humanitarian law and must stop immediately. The parties must also preserve the civilian character of public infrastructure. The special envoy stressed that he is ready to work with the parties to find immediate solutions to de-escalate the violence, address urgent humanitarian needs, and enable a political process aimed at sustainably and comprehensively ending the conflict in Yemen. UN officials in recent years have called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Grudenberg highlighted the conditions long faced by people across the country. Grudenberg said 2021 ended with a tragic year for Yemenis, millions of whom are struggling with poverty, hunger, and severe restrictions on their freedom of movement. In this regard, I reiterate the United Nations call for opening of Sana'a Airport and for removing obstacles hindering Yemenis' ability to move within or between governorates inside Yemen. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers earlier this month urged President Joe Biden to exert diplomatic pressure to end the Saudi-led coalition's ongoing closure of the airport. The continued restriction of commercial and humanitarian flights into the airport has exacerbated the ongoing crisis in Yemen and had a devastating impact on millions of innocent Yemenis, the lawmakers wrote, pointing out that restrictions on ports of entry are a form of collective punishment in violation of international and U.S. law. And that's, however, the Biden administration has come under fire recently for approving a $650 million arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which the United States Senate recently declined to block, sparking fierce criticism of the upper chamber's members and over the world across the political spectrum. Senator Bernie Sanders, who along with two Republicans led a resolution to block the transfer, said at the time that as the Saudi government continues to wage its devastating war in Yemen and repress its own people, we should not be rewarding them with more arms sales.
الشهيد Though 2 years have passed since the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, but the attacks on his personality haven't yet stopped. Since the beginning of the Syrian crisis, the Western media propaganda was to manipulate the masses with clever disinformation about Shia-Sunni conflict in order to create a barbaric image of him. They portrayed him as a villainous Iranian Shia general who wanted to murder, loot, and conquer the Sunni Arab world. But what really was his outlook about the Sunni community? I am Sarbazullah Rizvi, and in this episode of The Shaheed, we will look into his experience with the Sunnis, his standpoints on sectarian conflicts. You want to find out what he really was looking for in the region. Stay tuned. Member of Arab and Muslims Relations Office and representative of Islamic Resistance Movement of Hamas in Tehran. Dr. Khaled Qaddoumi, thank you for accepting our invitation. And salam alaikum. The first question, we all know that the propaganda against General Qasem Soleimani not only stopped but also accelerated after his assassination, his criminal assassination by United States. You, as someone who is representing the resistance movement of Palestine in Tehran, at the heart of Iran, should have been in contact with, General Qasem Soleimani closely. What was the attitude of General Qasem Soleimani about this dynamic of Sunni Shias, by which nowadays we are observing that he's being portrayed in a wrong way again and again by mainstream media?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, in our theme of thinking, we always believe that if you have been killed or assassinated by the enemy, then you are definitely an enemy to that enemy. So hence, the winning of the battle with General Soleimani, rahmatullah alayh, is that he has been assassinated by the hand of the, I would say, absolute hegemonic and barbaric forces in the world, that is the American forces, and that is the Zionist American ally. That is one. Second thing, I would like to remember or retrieve some of those memories of 10 years I spent in the Islamic Republic of Iran, where I was honored to meet the Martyr Soleimani many times.
Indeed.
He was away from being Sunni or Shia. He was the man of Quran. He was the man who always resort to the verses of the Holy Quran whenever he wants to augment his idea or his response to an opinion, or he wants to elaborate on something. So Quran and the verses of Quran were always there, and he always tried to take benefit of those interpretation of those verses of Quran. Now, when we talk about the narratives of hadith of our Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he used always to resort to those narratives which they are combinedly accepted by Sunni and Shia. Third thing, I personally and my movement never felt that we are talking to a man who is emphasizing the differences creed-wise. Well, in one hand, let me tell you that General Soleimani, rahmatullah alayh, was a pure and to the depth of his heart, Muslim following Ahlul Bayt and the Shia sect of Islam. That is, should have no doubt on that. But that never been a burden to him or to us to talk to each other. That was never a barrier on dialogue or on relation between us. Rather, he used to make you feel at home. He used to make you feel that he is resorting to those common ground, to those gray areas which we used to live together. That is third. Fourth thing, his way of living in the Palestinian issue was calling the roles of every Muslim, every component of resistance, school of thought in the region, in the Palestinian issue. Asking the Iraqis, the Iranian, the Lebanese, the Yemenis, the Palestinian in different school of thought, what are you going to do to Palestine? What are you going to do to safeguard the legitimate right of the Palestinian, the first Qibla of Muslimin? This was General Soleimani, rahmatullah alayh. He is a pure believer of Islam. He was resorting to the Holy Quran and its verses. He was a pure Shia, but he was never allowing his sectarian belief to be a barrier between him and other brothers. Rather, on the opposite, as I said, he used to call for what is the role and what is the function of every component of this Muslim ummah,
yeah,
to safeguard Palestine, Al-Quds, Masjid Al-Aqsa. This is what we knew about.
I remember one of the speeches which was really interesting for me personally, I'm speaking, where Shahid General Qasem Soleimani is talking about Palestine, then he's telling that Palestine is a 99% Sunni-dominated Muslim country. I mean, there may be very limited number of Shias over there in Palestine, but they are very limited. And then General Soleimani, something really important, I want to have your stand on that. He said, even if there is going to be a Shia movement in Palestine, we are not going to work with them. We are going to work with the Sunnis. What's your stand on that, and how do you look to that?
Well, listen, very, very, very straightforward. For any reputable and respectable project, like the school of thought of General Qasem Soleimani, he will be having components and pillars of his identity. One of major identity is his beliefs, cultural-wise, religion-wise, sect-wise, whatever.
Indeed.
That is, you have to deal with that. I mean, I am proud to say that I have lived with him the time he was different to me. He was never making us to feel that he's different from us. Rather, as I have said, that we are together. One. Second thing, there is no phenomena that we have felt or that we have witnessed in Hamas or in Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement that say that General Qasem Soleimani or even the Revolutionary Guard have tried to impose the sectarian beliefs on our society. Our society, as you have said, it has 99.9, maybe 100%, they are Sunnis. Many of them, they are of Shafi'i followers. On the other hand, we are more than 96-97% have enjoying 97% education rate. So it's not easy to say that you are talking to some emotional
yes.
nation so that they, you can enjoy the liberty of changing their own sect or something like
exactly.
that. If at all, I would like accept the notion of playing in the Palestinian ground. We are solid in that thing. On the other hand, as I have said, we have never experienced any endeavor or have seen that there is a phenomena that they, that Haj Qasem rahmatullah alayhi, or his brothers in the Islamic Republic, they wanted to impose any Islamic or religious belief on our society.
Very important point. We will pursue our talk with Dr. Khaled Qaddoumi after watching a part about the feedback of Muslim scholars on the demise and on the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani. Stay with us.
Not much on allegations of Iran's crusade to create a Shia crescent here. General or Sardar Soleimani, chief of Iran's Quds Force, is predominantly remembered as a military genius fighting for and beside Shia and Sunni equally in the fight against Daesh terror. In 2018, Soleimani visited Umm al-Tabwil Mosque in Baghdad, where he met the Sunni Mufti Sheikh Mahdi al-Sumaidi. The greatest resistance against 2003 U.S. occupation of Baghdad emanated from that mosque, and Soleimani's visit resonated in social media as a show of unity in a united Shia-Sunni resistance. As for Soleimani's stance towards Sunni-Shia unity, as he put it 6 years ago, I summarized, what blame the Islamic Republic of Iran and its IRGC force bear is for defending our Sunni brothers. The small-minded, scared Sunnis of Shias, whereas the greatest harm to Sunni communities has come from takfiris, that's false Muslim sects created by the Western enemy. Why shouldn't Iran stand against a group that trade 2,000 young women among themselves or stand against non-Muslims out to destroy mosques and Muslim centers? Name one country where Iran might have tried to convert Sunnis to Shia. That was an answer to political and media efforts to turn Sunni neighbors against predominantly Shia Iran. Hujjatul Islam Ismail Saadat has been the leader's representative in the Quds Force for years. He bears witness to what distaste the general had for emboldening anything different between Sunni and Shia. A clerical student had attempted to propagate the Shia sect of Islam among Sunnis in Syria, but Haj Qasem said, return him to Iran. We don't need such limited folk here. Also, in an Arabic letter to a Syrian household who hosted him during his Free Abu Kamal operation, he wrote, I am Sunni in a way, as I believe in the Sunnah or way of the Prophet, and you are Shia in a way, as you love the descendants of the Prophet. Now, domestically, General Soleimani, or Haj Qasem, as fans and followers affectionately call him, did something really clever or forward-thinking. He created a Sunni division in the Sar Allah battalion. As for an example of what Sunni Iranian religious leaders had to say of the martyr, Maulavi Abdul Hamid of Sistan Baluchistan province is regarded as a spiritual leader to Iran's Sunni population. He lamented days after the Soleimani assassination by a U.S. drone, there are few in the world in possession of military skills and experiences such as those of General Qasem Soleimani. Kurdish-Iranian Sunni religious leaders believe that Haj Qasem is no less popular with Sunni Muslims than Shia Muslims, given his great services to the region's Sunnis. The people will never forget the sacrifices made by him, General of Hearts. World Sunni leaders were of like mind. Maulana Fazlur Rahman is Pakistan's current president of the Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam faction. He said that the Americans proved they are in pursuit of adventurism and sparking new wars in the region. And now they have assassinated General Qasem Soleimani under the pretext of fighting terror. Iraq's Sunni cleric society didn't sit back. Its chief contributed at the Soleimani commemoration. Liaqat Baluch, deputy to Pakistan's Islamic society faction Jamaat Islami, also showed his appreciation by describing Soleimani as a valiant fighter for the faith who sacrificed his life for the freedom of Jerusalem al-Quds. Not to forget Iranian Sunnis fighting in Syria, a good reference and reminder would be the documentary A Child of Iran on the martyr Salman, one of Sunni Iranians martyred in Syria. On a final note, the leader of the revolution paid a call on families who'd lost their sons in Syria, one of them a Sunni family, not to make an issue of it. Although Ayatollah Khamenei did stress the importance of a Sunni Iranian presence in Syria.
In the Shaheed special program on the second martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani, I'm talking to Dr. Khaled Qaddoumi, representative of Hamas in Tehran. Dr. Qaddoumi, in the first part of our conversation, you talked about the feelings and the importance that General Qasem Soleimani was feeling towards Al-Quds Jerusalem and Palestine. Specifically speaking, what was his, you know, sentiments towards the first Qibla of Muslims, the primary Qibla of Muslims? I'm talking specifically about the Jerusalem Al-Quds. Palestine itself has different dimensions, but we all know that at the heart of the Palestinian cause, we have the issue of Al-Quds Jerusalem. And what was the feeling of, as a Muslim, as you mentioned that Shahid Soleimani was a Quranic man, was a man who was believing Quran and practicing Quran. And what was his feelings towards the first Qibla of Muslimin, Jerusalem Al-Quds?
Let me just elaborate on that. I mean, when we talk about Shahid Soleimani, we're not talking about a nominal figure. He is one of the engineers of policies in the region. He is also a school of thought. So he is multidimensional personality. So let me just correct that it's not feeling and it's not sentiment. It's something that he is obsessed by. And witnessly, I would like to recall the last meeting with him, rahmatullah alayh, which it was when we have visited the Supreme Leader, maybe a few weeks or a month after his assassination and his martyrdom.
Before his assassination.
And he was with us. We were with the Supreme Leader over here in Tehran, and Haj Qasem, rahmatullah alayh, and his brothers in Revolutionary Guard were hosting a top delegation of Hamas head by Sheikh Saleh Al-Aruri, the existing vice of the movement. I would recall the last idea and the last project which was given or engineered and articulated by Shahid Soleimani in the presence of Supreme Leader, where the Supreme Leader himself was really taking it very seriously, and we have understood what is Shahid Soleimani is all about and what is he thinking about. And that idea simply was, what will be the combined project of all components of the resistance axis in the region to contribute to defend the Palestinian Masjid al-Aqsa and al-Quds and to confront the Zionist regime and the Israeli crimes. And that was not a sentiment. That was an elaborated project where there were questions and answers among all of us, including His Eminence, the Supreme Leader. And that indicates actually two things. One, why he was assassinated? Because whenever you want to think of any serious project in the region, any unity project in the region,
you will
find Yes. Why he was assassinated, while he was targeted, because whenever you want to look for the point which wants to unite all of us on Palestine, to unite all of efforts to confront the common enemy of the Ummah, which is the Zionist regime, you will find Shahid Soleimani. That is one point. The second point, that Shahid Soleimani was not only distributing some lip services or sentiments or playing with our feelings. No, he offered his soul for this reason, for this cause. That is the Palestinian cause. This, irrespective of whatever being said in the region or in the international about the paradox which you have mentioned or the propaganda, I am witnessing what we have seen, what we have touched, what we have felt, what we have experienced about this Shaheed, that he was, to the depth of his heart, committed to the cause of Palestine more than any other cause, because simply he understood what is the crux of the unity among Muslim Ummah, what is the point which can focus, which can attract all the efforts with differences of sect and differences of school of thought among the Ummah and among also the free voices in the international level, and that is the Palestinian issue. We have lost a man who is a multidimensional brother to the resistance. He used to advise us, offer us military expertise, diplomatic expertise, religious expertise, and he was having a holistic approach the time when he is talking about Palestine, in a way that I was telling you that in that last meeting, with the attraction of attention of His Eminence, the Supreme Leader, and all resistance figures from Hamas who were attending that meeting, that how all of us in Muslim Ummah should leave our all differences, should leave our all marginal fights in different levels and in different fields, away from the major issue and focus on the major issue, and that is Palestine and Al-Quds. That was General Soleimani, rahmatullah.
Indeed. Thank you, Dr. Khaled Qadoumi, representative of Islamic Resistance Movement of Hamas in Tehran and member of Arab and Muslims Office Relations Office. Thank you for joining our discussion.
Barakallahu fikum.
Yes, this was my interview with Dr. Khaled Qadoumi, representative of Islamic Resistance Movement of Hamas in Tehran. We discussed about the belief, the real belief of General Qasem Soleimani to the unity of the Ummah, the one who was looking after unifying the Ummah to contribute what they should contribute for the main cause of Ummah, which is Palestine. Stay with us and follow us with the next part of our program, which is about, again, another personal dimension of the life of General Qasem Soleimani, a man with high spirituality. Stay with us.
Spirituality was a matter for both worlds to the general. Prayer brings peace and a closeness to God that makes his worshippers independent of anyone and anything else. It works as the guiding light that puts you on a path of righteousness and eventually carries you on into oneness with the Creator. This is General Soleimani's message in essence to compatriots and children of his martyred fellow compatriots. To him, prayer and reading the Quran was not just a ritual to bottle up till the next obligatory performance. It was to instill in worshippers a greater understanding and more fundamental worship of God, and hence greater disdain for the devil and false gods and oppressors. His was the Islam of the Prophet's household. That is, the Islam that teaches never to bow to bullying, but to apply your thought to wisdom. It is the original Islam, a doctrine to direct life and life-making. The Islam of knowledge and understanding. An Islam for the oppressed and deprived. Sheikh Khalid Mullah, a prominent Sunni Iraqi cleric, says, Haj Qasem Soleimani left his country behind to dwell in the desert, just to award Iraqis military advice on combating terrorism. He came to Iraq to protect Islam and Muslims, and he will go to Syria too. He practiced what he preached and advised compatriots powerful in the system to do the same. In the winter of 2010, he addressed a military crowd. Don't allow greed to take a hold of you, for whatever material goals and high positions you may gain are worthless. It were as if he didn't belong to this material plane. And it was this quality that kept him from pretense and boasting. The leader Ayatollah Khamenei recalls how the general just sat in a quiet corner at ordinary official meetings. It was such that if you needed him to bear witness or comment, you'd have to search for him. He kept away from the spotlight and never promoted himself. General Fallahzadeh says of Soleimani's spirituality, at the Aleppo Nasr base and Abu Kamal Sarallah base, he'd begin an hour before the morning prayer with night prayers. One night at the Nasr base, I heard him sobbing. I opened the door to find him at his prayer. Here's his will to God. I am losing my abilities. How can you keep the gates to your heaven shut to someone waiting 40 years on your doorstep? O Creator, O Love, whom I have asked constantly to fill me with your love, burn me and destroy me in my separation from you. You know well that I love you and want none other. Make me as one with you. He preached what he believed, and even practiced. In comforting children of martyrs, this is what he wrote. To summarize, he told Fatima, the daughter of Mehdi Maghfouri, 5 years ago, "My girl, talking to God alone in solitude is the best tranquilizer." And to another martyr's daughter, he wrote a year earlier, "My girl, anyone who gets to know God is drawn to him, especially in prayer. This keeps him away from sin. Understanding God means subjugation and satisfaction. It makes you needless of any other person." A compatriot of his, Hujjatul Islam Sa'adat Nejad, says in summary, "Haj Qasim was one for voluntary night prayers. I often saw him murmuring the Abu Hamza prayer or reciting it during night prayers. In mourning the saints, his tears were uncontrollable. They even moved me to tears."
In this episode of The Shaheed, we discussed about the idea of unity, Islamic unity, and General Qasim Soleimani. An idea in which Shaheed Soleimani had a strong belief, not only a strong belief, but for which he sacrificed his whole life. Thank you for being with us. Wassalam.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Thank you.
the limelight.
Sharply contrasting with $778 billion in new military spending authorized recently by President Joe Biden, the U.S. Agency for International Development reportedly can't find the funds to pay for the Biden administration's efforts to help vaccinate the world's population against COVID-19, according to two agency officials interviewed by Politico. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, USA is running out of money for COVID vaccines, while Pentagon got $778 billion. Stay tuned for more. Sharply contrasting with $778 billion in new military spending authorized recently by President Joe Biden, the U.S. Agency for International Development reportedly can't find the funds to pay for the Biden administration's effort to help vaccinate the world's population against COVID-19, according to two agency officials interviewed by Politico. In an article published recently by the website, a pair of unnamed sources at USAID, the main government agency in charge of distributing coronavirus vaccine doses to COVAX, the Global Vaccine Equity Program, are concerned that efforts could stall in the coming spring should the administration fail to find new funding sources. According to Politico, the agency, which works with officials in the State Department, has over the past year largely relied on more than $1.6 billion allocated through the American Rescue Plan to help facilitate the shipment and administration of COVID-19 vaccine doses internationally. The agency has either used that money or already earmarked it for several months into the new year to help countries prepare to receive and distribute the doses, the official said. Without additional funding, the official said that USAID will fall behind in its commitments to help the administration distribute hundreds of millions of U.S.-made doses to low- and middle-income countries by the middle of 2022. At the administration's first COVID-19 summit with foreign representatives in September, U.S. officials noted it would take at least $7 billion in 2022 to ensure shots are administered across the globe. Critics have noted that the $778 National Defense Authorization Act, approved by U.S. Congress, is $25 billion more than Biden requested and more than enough to vaccinate anyone in the world. Why is there more money for military-industrial complex providing no additional protection for national security and arguably diminishing it at the same time the U.S. is refusing to spend the $25 billion needed to make enough additional vaccines to vaccinate the world, recently asked Public Citizen President Robert Weizmann earlier this month, citing the consumer advocacy group's analysis of how much it would take to inoculate humanity. According to Politico, it is unclear how USAID, which in addition to providing developmental assistance, has been accused of democracy suppression, torture, and murder, will obtain fresh funding for the U.S. vaccine distribution efforts. The two officials said the agency is exploring options, including dipping into existing pots of money used for other USAID programs. Global South leaders have arguably decried vaccine inequities, with some linking the shortfalls with ever-increasing military spending. At September's United Nations General Assembly, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermudez noted that 80% of doses had been distributed to middle or high-income Haitians, comparing that statistic to the nearly $2 trillion in global military spending, more than one-third of it by the United States.
Aperture.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mireille neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirai is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators. Don't hang about right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now. Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but they're on public property. And we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. I mean, sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people, but slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the sixth floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just two floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys, because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town. It's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet. You can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside. When they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbor's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages like this one. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. There was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. The government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative.
Onde o carro está entrando ali agora,
You see down there where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers. So it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh, yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rosinha. Rosinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents.